Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk.
You have been led by the Spirit to Prophecy Keepers Radio, a cooperative service of the White Roots of Peace Council. Whether it be the modern Asaga of Peru, the current Kahunas of Hawaii, today's medicine people of the Americas, the Holy Ones of Africa, shamans of the East, North, West, and South, or the present-day Atawehis of the Cherokee, we bring you the traditional elders and teachers of our modern times and their confidants from the Americas, the steppes of Asia, the Holy Land, the islands of the sea, Africa, and Australasia. We have not been conquered, and we defy the established order. This is Will Bluewater, the host of Prophecy Keepers Radio, speaking on behalf of the White Roots of Peace Council.
It's 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow? It's 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow? It's 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow?
Thanks for listening to the Wisdom of the Elders on Prophecy Keepers Radio, revealing closely guarded ancient secrets here in the modern information age of Aquarius. This station's only means of support is through donations and purchases of the Prophecy Keepers Trilogy and Preparedness Library, which includes lifetime online access to a printable 1,000-page intelligence briefing and a worldwide indigenous prophecy encyclopedia. Now, folks, there's nothing else like this collection on the planet, all for $9.99, formerly priced at $29.99. You'll receive instant access to the Prophecy Keeper's Wisdom Treasury Vault. This is a huge 4.88 gigabyte library, 3,287 files and 222 folders. It includes the Prophecy Keeper's Prepper's Self-Reliance files and all of our previous over 100 Prophecy Keepers interviews. So head on over to prophecykeepers.com right now and have a free sneak peek today of two-thirds of the Prophecy Keepers trilogy and a peek of the dashboard of the Prophecy Keepers Wisdom Treasury Vault. Osio Ginalii Tahiju Toigu, which means, hello cousins, I'm fine, how are you? This is your old buddy Bluewater coming to you from the Cumberland Plateau in east central Tennessee, the ancient home of the Anuntikwalaski, the people of the lightning and thunder, or the military protectors of the old Cherokee Nation. And this is Bluewater Live. We've got a very special honored guest tonight. Buddy, before you say anything, let me tell folks a little bit about you. I can't remember how long I've known you, but it's been quite a while.
We go back about 05, I believe.
Something like that. And you're a descendant of a lot of people don't know. You know, there was two different routes of the Trail of Tears. The northern route went right through southern Illinois, and that's what your people were. The Henderson Purchase is just right across the Ohio River from you. And there's a lot of Cherokees in southern Illinois, and folks, this is a call-in show. We'd like you to hold your calls until the, maybe to the last half hour. We'll let Buddy decide that. The call-in number is right on the screen that you're looking at, or you can Skype in. But anyway, Buddy, I've had the honor of being associated with a lot of Special Forces veterans, and Buddy's one of them. And all these guys have been very special to me and a good influence on me ever since I read the book Outpost of Freedom by Captain Donlan back in my freshman year of college. These guys, and even before that, when I was in archery competition, Eddie Eliason, who's a world champion and a former Green Beret. And anyway, without further ado, let me first explain oh, I guess at the end of the Clinton administration, the decorations were declassified for the secret war in Laos. And there was a big to-do, but he wasn't able to go. But Pat and I've interviewed Pappy Hicks before. He's a past chief of the Texas Cherokees, and he's a descendant of Charles Hernandez Hicks, who was one of the first, well, before they had principal chiefs. He was in the chief's council. But I've got a special message from Pappy. Captain David L. Hicks ran the secret war in Laos. He was the counterpart for General Vang Pao, who just passed away this last January. And let me play this special message for you.
Hey, buddy, this is Pappy Hicks. All us guys are getting old now, and I tell you, we're getting to be the replicas. What am I trying to say?
Yeah.
Anyhow, the old codgers.
Right.
And World War II was bad, and then I'm Korea, and I'm right behind them. And now it's the people out of Vietnam that's getting to be there, and then people going to follow us up. And but we've been on our course. We've done run it. I'd like to run it again. We'll see, brother. Hang tough out.
And that's the way Pappy always ends, is hang tough. And I think he's 82 years old now. So.
Oh, yeah.
But, buddy, yeah, tell us about, you know, why don't you start, you know, when you were little and first found out you were Cherokee, and maybe get into, you know, whatever. Take us wherever you want to take us.
Oh, hey, you know, when you get as old as I am, you might not be able to go that far now. Well, I always knew my heritage from my great-grandmother. I'm one of the few people who really got to know the great-grandparents. And kids nowadays, their great-grandparents pass away before they even get to even see them or meet them, just in pictures, you know. So, my grandfather died at 98. My grandmother lived to be well into her 90s. So I always had it handed down to me where we came from and what we were. So I always knew I was Native American. And I always said just Indian. And when we'd go to school, like in Thanksgiving and things, we'd get up and do Indian dances and stuff. And I remember the kids used to make fun of me and say, if you was an Indian, you would have a card in your pocket. And my grandmother never had a card. Now, her sisters and all of them, they had land in Oklahoma and Cherokee, North Carolina. And that's still handed down, still in the family. So I went to my grandmother one day. I said, Grandmother, I want one of those cards. And she always called me buddy. She said, now, little buddy, do you need one of those cards to prove that you're a Native American or an Indian? I said, well, no, Grandmother, I don't, but nobody believes me at school. And she said, it doesn't make any difference what they believe at school. You know what you are. So that's why today I've never followed through to get a card or anything from a Cherokee in Oklahoma or Carolina, because I always knew what I was. And there's a girl right now, and I can't think of her name. She sent me some emails. She's helping people in Oklahoma apply for their cards and everything. And I told her about my grandmother's sisters and their kids and on down the line up there as Sally Muskrat and Nancy Knee Glass. And she done a check on Rump Fest in, I think it's the Dawes or the Millersville. I'm not for sure which one now.
Millers in the East.
And she said, are you kin to the Muskrats in Weber Falls, Oklahoma? I said, Well, yeah, that's part of the bunch right there.
But that makes you a Southern Cherokee.
Well, they, on the Trail of Tears, they marched them from Carolina to Oklahoma. And then they got their own numbers and applied for land in Oklahoma. But then I've got the paperwork where then in Oklahoma they applied for land, tribal land in Carolina. So they had land in both places.
Mm-hmm.
I never did do the full checkout on it, but I'm not for sure if it was the Miller Row or the Dawes Row. I guess the Dawes Row was in Carolina. Is that right?
No, it was the first was the Henderson Row. That was the Emigration Row, 1835.
Okay.
There was one, I believe, in 1817, but 1835 was the last Emigration Row. It really wasn't a roll. But the base roll for the Eastern Band is the Miller Roll.
Okay. I didn't go that far in detail to even check them. I did get that downloaded one time and checked it out and found some of my ancestors, you might say, that's way on down the line. But I never did follow through with it. Now, I did do a check and contact some people in Oklahoma that knew some of my family out there, but I haven't seen them in so many generations. It would be like probably my fifth or sixth cousins or eighth cousins, I guess, right now. So I never did follow through to get a BIA card. And I know some Native Americans, some Lakotas, and some Cherokees both that stowed their cards away. They're worthless. That's what they tell me, they're worthless. But it's like my buddy, I call him my brother, Casper Thunderhawk, up at Standing Rock Reservation. He can't get good medical up there. And he's having trouble with diabetes, and somebody's kidney shutting down or something. And I was talking to him last week, and he said he's going to have to go to Bismarck, North Dakota, in order to see a good doctor. Because
yeah.
The reservation, they don't have any good medical. I've seen the hospital there. They got a nice hospital, but he said there's no really good medical there.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I stopped at Pine Ridge every time I go up to Standing Rock. I stop at Pine Ridge, and it just makes you want to cry when you see how the people are living up there. And, you know, you talk to a lot of people, and you talk about a reservation, they think it's full of teepees and stuff like you see on television. But, the houses. They show you pictures of the Bronx and the ghettos, like in these big cities on the outskirts and how people are living. But they don't ever show nobody how they're living at Pine Ridge. And if you've seen some of the old houses that's fallen in, I mean, it gets 50, 60 below zero up there. They don't have windows, or they put plastic over just the open hole where a window was.
Mm-hmm.
And the gangs is taking over so bad at Pine Ridge. They're killing each other. I said, what is going wrong? Dakota is killing Lakota. I guess that's whip Custer. They ain't got nobody else to whip, so they decided they're going to whip each other.
Well, the Hopi had a prophecy that someday their boys would start shaving their heads, and that's what they did when they started getting together with the Hispanic gangs and running with those kids, and that fulfilled that prophecy. Yeah, it's you can probably get better care away from in health system, because none of the doctors want to get into it, or if they do, they don't want to be in it very long. And yeah, it's really sad.
Oh, it makes me want to cry. And I've got some friends at Pine Ridge, and I was talking to Casper here a while back, and I told him I was going to stop at Pine Ridge to see a few people on my way up there this time. And he said, bro, I'm going to tell you something. He said, if you stop at Pine Ridge this time, you better have a bulletproof vest on, because he said bullets is flying everywhere up there.
Jeez.
And I said, well, I don't guess I'll stop at Pine Ridge this time. And it's a shame. I just wanted to cry when I was up there last time. I stopped by where Wounded Knee was and the burial ground and all that. And I just couldn't believe how the people was living. I thought, man, they talk about how Americans are living here in the shacks and the ghettos, and you go up there and nobody, they keep that secret. They don't want to show you anything on TV about it, because those houses is terrible, and the government doesn't want to do a darn thing to help them out.
Yeah. Well, they want them to take the money for the Black Hills. It's, you know, billions of dollars sitting in the bank, and they won't do it.
Yeah, exactly right. Exactly right. And there's oil up there on North and South Dakota up there. and just right out of Sturgis, Dakota, there's a sacred mountain, and Bear Butte, I think it is, I'm not for sure.
Yeah.
But there's oil all over, and they're wanting to put
oil. Oh, yeah, it's a huge.
Governments want to put oil wells in, but they don't want to give the Native Americans who own that property any money off of it whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. It's a bigger pool than the Saudis have.
Yeah.
And it's right under the res. And in Canada, what they do is they just pump it out and they give the First Nations 10%. They take 90%.
Yeah, there's got to be a stop to that someplace where, I don't know, but as long as they're going to stay drunk and on the meth and the other drugs, they're not going to do anything. And I go up there. Now, Standing Rock is one of the better reservations up there. And it's really nice and clean. You can drive anywhere in that whole area, and it's many square miles. You won't find any litter on the ground. You won't find any trash. I mean, it's a very nice, clean place. And I found out with Lakota, to get their respect, you got to give them the respect to earn it. I mean, they're just not going to just respect you right off the bat. They're all hard. Find them hard to get to know.
Mm-hmm.
But it took me a few years to really get in to know them. And when they invite you to stay at your house, or invite you to stay at their house, that means something very big, because most of them won't invite you to sleep at their house for the weekend or for a week, as long as you want to. And I was telling another friend of mine up there, he said, I mean, Casper said you could stay at his house. You didn't have to put a tent up and camp while you're here. I said, no, he buy me a stay at his house. He said, you're very special to that man. He said, they just won't invite you to stay at their house.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, that's really great. I thought that was really great.
Well, Ed McGaugh told me, he says, if you want to get their instant respect, remind them that we ran them out of Long Island off of Georgia. That we ran them out on the plane. And he says, then they'll know you're really a Cherokee, because you really remember that. Yeah.
I have had a ball up there. I'd love to stay up there in the summertime. But, oh, in the wintertime, I was up there in November buffalo hunting. I took Chief AJ up and the WC boys, if anything, wild, it's on the Pursuit Channel. And I took them up there buffalo hunting. And Chief AJ shot a 2,800-pound buffalo.
Mm.
And that was a monster. It took me 2 months to get this thing set up. But we got it set up, and AJ has made the Ruger 10/22 very famous. He made Ruger very famous, like they was already famous, but he just put the icing on the cake with them.
Mm-hmm.
I think he still got the world record of shooting. He shot 48. Those little wooden blocks that's got the ABCs on them.
Mm-hmm.
In 8 days, I think he shot 48,000, a few hundred more, to set the world record. And I don't think anybody's even come close to beating it now.
He's a hell of a marksman, and he's a mighty man. He's up there, but you know, he looks like Jack LaLanne. I mean, the guy where he really works out.
He's got the world record of the oldest man bench pressing 300 pounds.
Oh, my God.
I don't know anybody in their 70s can bench press 100 pounds, really, let alone him pumping up 300 pounds. But the Ruger 10/22, what really put the icing on the cake on this buffalo hunt is because we had it set up, and it just fell in line as 10/22. The day we got up there was 10/22,
mm-hmm.
And that's Ruger 10/22. And we didn't know until we got there that it was 10/22. So, and then while we was waiting to do the buffalo hunt, it was election day. Nobody does anything election day. So, Casper and this other guy, Bill, was a scout. He was telling about a pronghorn, a big pronghorn that was running number 5 behind four or five other young ones. So they took AJ and put him down in a cully, which is a valley, and they got the antelope and run them through, and AJ shot that thing.
Mm.
It turned out to be a Boone and Crockett record, not only
oh,
Dakota,
wow.
but South Dakota, too. So, and then the next day, AJ got the 2,800-pound buffalo. So, he was just one big happy Indian over that.
I'll bet.
But he didn't know it was a record book until he got home. He was going to throw the hide and the horns and everything away. And I asked him, I said, AJ, what are you going to do with that? He said, oh, I don't know. I was thinking about just throwing it away. We took and cooked it out. We cleaned it and cooked it out on the grill up there. And he was going to just throw it all away. And I told him, I said, well, if you go throw it away, let me have it, because I'll do something with it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he kept it, and he took it to a guy, a taxidermist over by his house, and they measured the horns, the length, and the width, and it turned out to be the Boone and Crockett record for North Dakota and South Dakota.
Wow.
And that was in 07, and no one's beat that yet. So it made him a very happy guy.
Well, you know, Cherokees are good marksmen, just naturally. Let's see. The world archery champion in 1968 was Ray Rogers. Big, beefy guy, drove a bread truck out of Tahlequah. 1970, Hardy Ward, another Cherokee. And 1957, O.K. Smathers was world champion. He's out of North Carolina. And there's been a lot of them. They pretty, in the late 60s, 50s, and 60s, oh, and not to mention Joe Thornton, who's a TV repairman out of Tahlequah. They dominated the sport through the 40s, 50s, and 60s, and into the 70s. Yeah, we're getting a lot of good competition from the Finns and the Chinese, but I think the reason why is because Hardy Ward is over in China coaching the Chinese team. Anyway.
I was trying to think of the other guy's name that was right up there. He took over when Fred, or who was it, Max Bear?
Fred
Bear. Had the bear bow?
Fred
Bear, wasn't it? I was thinking of Max Bear, the boxer. But anyway, this guy, he's got a Scottish name, Mech something. I've seen him shoot, his wife took her wedding band off of her finger and held it between her thumb and forefinger. And he shot an arrow right through the center of it.
Ooh.
And I've seen him shoot quarters out of the air with an arrow, too.
I think you're talking about Howard Hill.
No, it's not Howard Hill. He's got a Scottish name, Mick. Starts with M. Mick.
I don't know. Howard Hill, another Cherokee descendant. Back in the 30s, he did exhibition shooting, and he could hit anything moving in any direction as long as it's within 100 feet, and he did it instinctively.
Oh, yeah. And that's how Chief AJ shoots instinctively.
But you get through your childhood, and then you join the Army. Walk us through that and how you ended up in Laos.
Well, I did plan on winding up there.
Okay, well, whatever you want to do.
After my cousin got killed in Vietnam, I was still going to high school. I was just had graduated my sophomore year and was in my senior year. And I was 17, and I just had felt the urge I needed to go. So I told my mom, I was the only son. My mom's first husband was killed in World War II, so I was the only son, and she did not like the military. So I told my mom, I said, if you don't sign me up in the military, I went up and talked to a recruiter, and he said, well, you're 17, you got to have your parents' consent to sign the papers to get you in. I went home, and I talked to my mom about it. Well, that started the war dance right there. So I told her, I said, if you don't go up and sign the papers, Mom, I said, I'm going to run away from home, and you'll never see me again.
Mm-hmm.
Well, my dad being in World War II in combat, and he knew what that was all about. He tried to talk me out of it. I said, no, Dad, I'm going. So they went up and signed the papers, and 30 days from the time my mom sent me in, that was, let's see, January, that was February 29th, 30th, something like that, I got a letter. So a few days later, got on a bus, went to St. Louis, Missouri, and then from there they shipped us to Fort Leonard Wood. And from there, it just started out rolling and rolling. I hooked up with, after I got out of basic and AIT, I went to a leadership school and become an E5 out of graduating out of that. And then I run into these special forces up at PX one day and talking to them. And I hadn't met Pappy Hicks at that time. I had met Colonel Mitchell and a few others, and started talking to them, and they asked me, and I was the youngest one. There was nobody younger than me, or even my age at that time. These guys had been in World War II, Korea, I mean, and all kinds of other battles around the world. I couldn't tell you how many different battles Pappy was in. But he was very experienced, and all of them was, and that's what they was looking for, experienced people or somebody they could train to be experienced. So I hooked up with them just, I was in the Philippines. I can't remember where in the heck I was at, in special guerrilla warfare training in the Philippines, and I started at Fort Benning, Georgia. We're going back about 50 years ago now, so I'm a little rusty now, Blue Otter.
Mm-hmm, so go.
But I went from Fort Benning, Georgia, from a place called Tigerland. That was probably one of the best United States guerrilla warfare training camps there was. Then I went to the Philippines for more advanced guerrilla warfare training. And I'll tell you what, if you ever been in the military with some Filipinos, now I'm tell you, those guys are something wild, treacherous. So that's where I met with Mitchell and those guys at, during the Philippines at the PX. I got off the airport there for like 6 weeks. And those guys, they wouldn't let us go in town because those people were ruthless. They didn't like American soldiers, especially over there. And they would be known to kill American soldiers right and left. You got off the beaten
path. Mm-hmm.
So we was just more restricted to training and the base, to the PX, and we wasn't allowed really off the post. So that's why I met Mitchell and a few up there. And then we went to Vietnam for 6 months training there. And that's when I met Pappy Hicks from Saigon. And through Mitchell and them other guys. Them guys was like my father. And it was so good to hear Pappy's voice on the phone just then. My God, that just gave me cold chills, Ronner, I tell you. I've been calling him, and all I get is an answering machine, so I figured he might be with his son in Carolina. I didn't know, but anyway, I met those guys, met Pappy Hicks, and I signed up with them guys. And from there, after I had my 6 months training in Nam, then I went with them over to Cambodia. And we worked up. The first year, I was with them up in the mountain people, and we trained the young kids. We more or less built our own army. We didn't. It was all covert operations. We had help, but it was all covert help, and it was our job. I don't know. We was always outnumbered. I don't think we ever had a fair battle. It was always outnumbered, and we trained the kids to go to battle with us. They couldn't hold an M14. We didn't have any M16. I've never seen an M16 when I was over there with Hicks and them, but had M14s. And Pappy and Colonel Mitchell, they flew to South Korea someplace and brought back a plane load of 30 caliber carbines. The little M1s?
M1 carbine, yep.
Yeah, and some of them kids still couldn't put one on the shoulder and shoot it. They we we call them hip shooters. These young boys, 10, 11-year-olds that wanted to join, we'd use them for messengers, run back and forth. We try to keep the teenagers on up and anybody we get to join. And these young kids could put a rifle to their shoulder, especially a carbine, and they would shoot from their hip. And they were very good at what they did. And they helped us win that battle. And I don't remember what our odds was. They wasn't good. I think we fought. There was like 40,000 of them against us. Yeah, I'm not for sure. I think you told me, I was talking to you here a while back, how many that we was fighting against. Was it like 30,000 or 40,000?
Yeah, I think the reports are that over a period of time the CIA recruited about 30,000 Hmong. So, you know,
uh-huh.
You know, probably about 20% of them might have been in the field. So, you know, might have had, you know, 5,000, you know, combat troops. You know how that is.
So I did my year with Happy, and he came up to me, and I was about 19 at that time, and I was due to come back to the States, and Pappy asked me, he said, we're going to lose a lot of good young guys here, and you're very well trained, buddy. He said, how about sticking here, I'll get you promoted to Staff Sergeant E6, and get you some money and get you a 2-week paid vacation home. And I thought about it because my mom and dad and my family was all planning the big homecoming and everything. And I knew just give me the promotion and let's hit it. He said, you don't want to go home? I said, if I go home, I ain't coming back. So I stayed there. And it was all good. The last year we was up in a place called the Horseshoe, way up north up in the Leo. And we was fighting more Red Chinese and Russian sympathizers and things of that sort more than BC. And that's what our job was. We was ambushing those guys up there. And there was bunches of them coming in. And they come in up from the north and cut over into North Vietnam. And then they'd work their way on down. It was very interesting. It was very hot.
Yeah.
Both ways, both in more ways than one.
Well, you know, Pappy told me. He said the government knows who's an Indian and who isn't. And he said back in those days, he says they were actively looking for Native descendants because
that's what I put on my papers. I put Native American.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Hey, but any chance did you run into a guy by the name of Charlie Davis over in Laos?
I don't know, Blue Otter. It's been so many darn years down
friend,
the road.
Friend of mine wanted me to ask. And
I know some Davis. I remember the name Davis.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know if his name was Charlie. I know so many Charlies and so many Davises and other names.
Davises are... Yeah, they're descendants of Pocahontas, but her mother was Cherokee, Ketua clan, Wild Potato clan.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, yeah. Davis is probably the most common. It's more common than Smith and Jones and all that stuff and Native people. And that's among all the tribes. I think it's the number one most common name.
I think if you look in the phone book, you'll find more Smiths and Davises than any other name.
It goes Smith, Jones, Johnson, and Anderson nationwide is the four most common names. But among Native people, Davis is very, very common. Jefferson Davis. I mean, look at his face. He had that real high cheekbones. But he was from Vicksburg, and he was a Pocahontas descendant. And so they got the blood real early, going back to the 1600s.
I've got some old... metal pictures of my grandmother's, great-grandmother's sisters and them. And they're on metal pictures. I've never seen metal pictures before, but they were shot on metal of some kind.
Daguerreotypes.
They're
daguerreotypes is what they're called, yeah.
Is that right? And they're on metal?
Yeah.
I don't know how they did it.
Late 1800s.
They're black and white.
Yeah, they look kind of sepia tone and... Didn't mean to get you off track. And
oh, that's all right. I'm always off track.
And because you were talking about the resistance and the numbers, you know, and how
I don't know if it ever come out about the Red Chinese coming in. I don't know if they ever released it. I haven't really kept up a lot with that. I try to forget a lot of it. But I know the Russians was really thick and heavy up there, and the Red Chinese, I've seen. It's unbelievable how many Red Chinese that come in through up there.
Mm-hmm.
And since China's given us money and loaning the government money, I don't know if they ever released that out or not. But
well,
that's because they know it now.
Laos, I mean, that was how they were supplying the North Vietnamese, was through Laos. And the only way to interdict it was secretly, because we didn't have a declaration of war against Laos, so you couldn't officially be there.
No. And we got orders straight from the president, handed right on down. And so a lot of times we got orders, I didn't know who they come from.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I had a class 3, I think it was a class 3 top secret clearance. All of us had secret clearances.
Sure.
Just some that was on a need-to-know basis.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how we always work. We need to know. If you need to know, you know. And if you didn't, somebody else would tell you.
Mm-hmm. Well, what the people, you know, you and I were talking earlier about, you know, they're mountain people. I know Mad Bear Anderson traveled and walked up into the mountains in Southeast Asia back in the 50s, late 50s, early 60s. And you know, he said, hey, you know, they wore turbans and...
Traditionally.
And he just felt like, you know, and of course the Cherokees were seagoing people and were afraid of floods, always moved up into the mountains. And... And these people, they use blowguns?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, well, yeah, blowguns.
Crossbows. Mm-hmm. I mean, they live traditionally way up in the mountains. They're very smart people, very kind-hearted people, hard-working people. And I gave them all the respect in the world they needed, and they respected us. It wasn't kind of like to your face and behind your back, they're ready to shoot you with a blowgun or something, you know.
Mm-hmm.
These people were very humble, very nice people.
And they lived in the mountains in Laos, Vietnam, and China, in that corner area. And so they were kind of, you know, they were just a people that were up there and you know, mountain people and, you know, living in somebody else's sovereignty. And I know, you know, Vang Pao was, Lieutenant General Vang Pao, you know, was their leader during that period of time. He was a Lieutenant General in the Royal Lao Army. And and hailed as a hero here, you know, thousands of Hmong people migrated here to the United States, thanks to him. But, you know, in 2007, the feds threw a net over him and accused him. And, you know, he's in his late 70s, accused him of shipping arms into Laos. And, you know, he was going to murder thousands of people. And I'm thinking, wow, you know, it's okay for the New World Order to decide, you know, that they're going to murder thousands of people. But, you know, the people themselves aren't allowed to decide. And that's been that way for, you know, a couple hundred years.
Oh, but, yeah. I knew a top CIA guy. His name was, I used to call him Mr. Wilson from the Dennis Smith Show. I used to call him Mr. Wilson all the time. He'd get kind of aggravated. But after I named him, you know, his name was Edwin P. Wilson. And it was kind of low on the totem pole with CIA back then, but then in the years to come, he got very wealthy. And, I mean, this guy had IBM missiles and transported them. He sold a M16 to Gaddafi. And,
well, he's in Wikipedia. Look at Edwin P. Wilson, born 1920, former CIA officer, was convicted of illegally selling weapons to Libya. Grew up in a poor farming family in Idaho and joined the Marines the Korean War. And so he was in there.
Yes, sir, man. And he was a hell of a nice guy. I mean, you know what I put? Ruthless as can be, I wouldn't want him to be my enemy. But, yeah, he sold the M16 to Gaddafi and was going to take a plane load back for millions of dollars. He's the only guy I know ever sold a CIA agent that ever sold a rifle or something, even explosives, to somebody and went to prison. This guy served. He was down here at Marion at the federal penitentiary for many years. I was wanting to go down and see him.
22 years.
Under the circumstances, I didn't go visit him.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if he died in prison or if he got out.
They released him September 14, 2004. He swore he was working at the behest of the CIA.
Oh, yeah. They had all kinds, tons and tons of money. He could go and get anything he wanted. If he wanted a C-47 or B-52, all he had to do is go requisition it and get the paper signed and or fortune, have him fortune, and go get a bomber. This guy had a lot of power.
Well, he was put on trial four separate times, found not guilty of trying to hire a group of Cubans to kill Cubans to kill a Libyan dissident. He was found guilty of exporting guns, including the one used in the Bonn assassination, and of shipping the explosives, and sentenced 15 years to in prison, and the former and 17 years for the latter. Whilst awaiting trial, he allegedly approached a fellow prisoner and attempted to hire him to kill the federal prosecutors. Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if he's still alive or not. Now, if he got out of prison in 04, that's quite some time ago.
Yeah, he's still alive.
I don't know. He's got to be up in age, I'm sure.
83 to 84.
Uh-huh. Oh. But he was always in what they call wet operations.
Mm-hmm.
And wet meaning blood. When you talked about a wet operation, that means everybody's going to die on that side.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe some on our side, but nobody was going to live on that side. Everybody had to die.
Mm-hmm.
And that was called wet operations.
A guy named Margolis wrote an article, Edwin Wilson, America's Man in the Iron Mask. It's big eye.
Sounds like him.
Yeah, interesting.
Iron Mask, yeah.
The Man in the Iron Mask, yeah. Yeah, it starts out, it says, the shocking case of a former CIA officer, Edwin P. Wilson, recalls the words of the great American thinker H.L. Mencken, quote, every decent man is ashamed of the government he lives under, unquote. Yeah.
Hey, he was a heck of a nice guy. Way I knew him, he was a nice guy. You didn't want to know him if he was your enemy. You didn't want to even meet him, you know. And I used to know so many others, but over the years, Blue Otter, you just kind of erase stuff in your mind. You kind of like your hard drive. You got to defrag it once in a while.
Mm-hmm. Well, you can't even get a DD-214. What do you have, a discharge letter?
You know, to your truth, I found that my last orders, and it had me ordered at my mom and dad's address in Benton. It said Sergeant Buddy Hosek, assigned to 124 North Frisco Street, Benton, Illinois, to await further orders. And I was laughing, telling my son, I let my son read him. He'll be 29 November. And I was letting my son read him. He said, and you've never heard anything from him, Dad? And I said, no. As far as I know, that was my last duty post, and that's where I guess I'm supposed to be until I hear from him. So I don't have a clear DD-214, but
so
I always
where
got
was,
my...
where was 124 Benton Street?
That was my home address where my mom and dad lived and where I was born at.
That's interesting.
You know, it's just very interesting how the military does things like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're lucky they even have, you know, said you were even ever in the service, because they can expunge you, they can make you disappear.
Oh yeah, erase your history. And I've tried Congressman Jerry Costello for years to get my folders opened, and Senator Richard Durbin. I've met him. I've been invited to the White House for coffee and donuts, everything else, but for them to get my records open is impossible. I thought, you know, if a congressman can't do it, a senator surely could.
Mm-hmm.
And Senator Gary Forby lives here in Benton. I went to school with him from the first grade all the way up through high school. We're still friends. He's been a senator for several years. And he said, buddy, if Congressman Costello and Senator Durbin can't get nothing done, I sure can't get anything done.
Well.
And I'm sure you know Richard Durbin. He's right up there, real famous of the senators, and he can't get anything done.
Yeah, I mean,
so I just write it out.
Senators, you know, they've got more power than, you know, about anybody. And I mean, you talk about powerful, senators are powerful.
I should have, if I know Obama was going to be like he is, I should have worked on him when he was senator.
Mm-hmm.
He might have been able to do something now.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I've heard that, you know, once you become a bird colonel, that you have access to all kinds of stuff that you can't even dream of, you know, that officers in lower ranks can't even dream of. You know, once you get those eagles on your collars, things change. And I know my dad was a Navy captain, and you know, they offered him flag rank, and you know, after 35 years, between 1945 and 1980. You know, he just basically gave him the finger. And, you know, he was a close personal friend of John Warner, and, you know, worked for him at Pentagon when he was Secretary of Defense. And Dad was on a short list for Secretary of the Navy, you know, during 9/11. But he told me, he said, hey, there wasn't any way that attack was not sponsored by someone inside the government. And, you know, this used to be a neutral nation, you know, and I heard Huckabee talking tonight about, the Swiss, they're not fighters, they're neutral. And I said, the reason why they're neutral is nobody dares. I mean, they start teaching those, they put a shove a gun in their kids' hands in infancy. They're the best marksmen in the world. And the Nazis were scared to death; they would not go up against them. And they have militia system that Ben Franklin recommended, and the way their government's put together, they're a confederacy of cantons, and one canton, you know, can't surrender the whole nation, and they can fall back into the mountains and fight forever. And people shouldn't laugh about the Swiss. Because Barbara Bachman went through that thing this week and about Switzerland, and anyway, I didn't mean to sidetrack you.
Oh, that's all right. I've been sidetracked for quite some time, Blue Otter. You know that.
Saw a lot of action. He probably went through PTSD and who knows what all, and probably got a dose of Agent Orange.
Hey, we've been sprayed by it. Pappy, too. We've been out in the jungles, and the chopper's coming up by, and we get sprayed along with everything else.
Mm-hmm.
I'm surprised Pappy hadn't got something wrong with him about that.
Oh, about the way he told me, he says he's taken, you know, a couple years ago I talked to him, and he was fainting all the time because he had so many fragments. Hang on a second. He had so many mortars explode behind him. But he says he's on medication now, and so he's not having that problem anymore. He says he recently got back from a trip to Idaho, and he said, man, he says, I don't think I'm going to leave home again. He says that trip was hard. But, he's 82 years old, and you get up those times, especially all the physical things you got wrong with you, you know, I'd say he's doing pretty good.
Well, he's got shrapnel in his head from a grenade from World War II.
Mm.
That was giving him some trouble. I've been in his war room three or four times down there, go troop and visit him, and we'd sit in a war room, and he's got souvenirs from, I think, every battle he's been in. I guess he's... Did you say he's living in Carolina with his son?
No, he's in troop. Or he's in.
Oh, is he in truth?
Well, yeah, I think he's. Well, he answered. I called his son Daniel, and he answered the phone because his phone is attached to a fax machine.
Oh, okay.
And Buddy answers. He's at the phone number that's in the white pages under Daniel Hicks.
Did he say what was going on with the West Texas Cherokee tribe?
No. No, we didn't talk real long. And I said, we'll talk. Maybe do an interview if you feel like it. But yeah, I'll give you the phone number. You can give him a call.
That'd be great. Talk to him. Because I found a card. And I don't know if that was his number now or not. I called that number 4 or 5 times over the last month and just get an answer machine.
Mm-hmm.
If I could get a letter from him stating that we was in combat together where we was at, that would open the door for me down the road a little bit. You know what I mean?
Good.
So... get him remember. I don't know if he actually remembers me. I'm sure he does. I don't know why he wouldn't. But
did you not get the Agent Orange settlement?
No, I don't have it. I've been tested for it so far. I don't have it. But now I was diagnosed with something called erythema a long time ago, and this doctor, he was a civilian doctor, wasn't a VA. And he asked me if I had ever been around any pesticides or, like, toxic chemicals, strong pesticides. I said, oh, I guess maybe Raid or, you know, something like that. He said, no. He said, I'm thinking of something a lot stronger than that. And he didn't say anything about Agent Orange or nothing, but he just said erythema. And I've never even looked it up on a Google. I should have Googled that. But I just thought of that. So, erythema. You got a computer handy?
Yeah, erythema is redness of the skin. It's caused by hyperemia of the capillaries in the lower layers of the skin. It occurs with any skin injury, infection, or inflammation. And it appears when you push against the skin, you know, it'll it disappears when you push against the skin. And while purpura or bleeding in the skin, pigmentation does not. And but yes, apparently it's unexplained, you know, redness of the skin.
Well, he was thinking it was some form of a pesticide, like a toxic chemical pesticide, like stronger than Rage. So, and it didn't dawn on me. If he'd have mentioned Agent Orange, I'd said, well, yeah, I've had it sprayed on me, and we loaded in helicopters before. And I had it swashed on me, but so far the VA has tested me for it. I haven't showed anything.
Mm-hmm.
But I know in the last 3 years, I think 57 veterans has died from Agent Orange up there at the Marion VA hospital.
Well, it's associated Agent Orange, and it's you can Google search the two of them, and they are associated. And. Yeah, mystery illness in Vietnam, sickens 191, and so they it just doing a redness of the skin, and what year did you get out of the service?
70,
of course, you were
about 71.
You were also involved. You were at Mena, Arkansas, and run into somebody we all know.
Oh yeah, Billy Bad Boy.
Mm-hmm.
He used to call me the long-haired hippie. He never gave me a name. He just used to call me a long-haired hippie because I always had long hair.
Barry Steele you run into. Of course, you're a pilot.
Oh, yeah. Barry used to have these big thighs. He had we used to call him, his nickname, Barry Steele's nickname was called Thunder Thighs. He had these big thighs. And hell of a pilot. I was a pilot, too. And I used to co-pilot with him all the time. Better not say. I don't know if it'd be good to say where and what and everything. I don't know if any of that's out now or not. But Barry had a bad deal done to him. Bill was turning on everybody at that time. Most of all his top security men have been murdered, supposedly committed suicide.
couple of them. One guy by the name of Buddy, my nickname, he went to left his wife and go get a pack of cigarettes. He was sitting at a red light down there, and just some people had pulled up and shot him while he's sitting at a red light. He was an ex-state trooper. All of Bill's bodyguards and security was ex-state troopers.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of them was nice guys. I never got to get personally with any of them.
A lot of them ended up dead, too.
Oh, yeah, every one of them.
Mm-hmm. Oh, by the way, you can Google you can Google Thunder Thighs Barry Seal, and you can read some interesting stuff.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was machine gunned down. They said it was the drug cartel out of Mexico, and I knew that was BS. He just knew too much, and everybody was indicted at the time to go to federal grand jury. Nobody wanted anybody to point fingers at, especially at Bill and them. And so they just started eradicating all of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's about 30 people that were around, the Clintons that just died early, like in their 30s and 40s. And it's kind of a joke in Arkansas. They call it being Arkansided.
Well, they had another airport besides there in MENA, but you couldn't get a big military transport in it like you could MENA. That was more for smaller planes and things like that.
They were smuggling them in the nose cones of those planes, weren't they? From what
they did in the nose cones. And, with the CIA in charge of all of it, they just had it right there in the open. And a lot of that, when we'd take and deliver it to Bill, it would be in coolers. And somebody would get a beef heart or some beef livers or kidneys and put ice down. Down under the eyes would be the cocaine. And on top would be liver transplant.
Mm-hmm.
Or a kidney transplant, heart
mm-hmm,
transplant.
Mm-hmm.
These would just be nothing but beef kidneys or, pork kidneys. I don't know what they was for sure,
mm-hmm.
but they looked like a kidney or something, or a heart. And if anybody stopped us, they would say, oh, well, they're in a hurry. This is going to a donor real quick, you know. And
mm-hmm.
then that's how they would come and pick it up. So,
According to hold that thought. You're gonna. Well, go ahead. I don't want to sidetrack you. You're gonna. What were you gonna say?
I tell you what got Barry killed. I told him he was stupid when he did it, but he set George and his brother up, Bush, George W. and his brother Jeb, down in Florida. He took a plane load of cocaine down there and had it videotaped and cameras and everything, and videotaped both of them taking charge of it. And they had that Beach Queen, King Air. And George had that for years. That was his private airplane, more or less. He loved that airplane over anything he had. And they changed the N number on it and everything. How, government, they can do anything they want to. So Barry set them guys up, had it all recorded, and then called the DEA and the bus stop. And when they all come in and converged, who did they catch? They caught George and Jeb. And I told Barry, I said, you're crazy for doing that, and I'm getting out of here while the getting's good. So that's the last I've seen of him or any of them. And it wasn't a good guy. He got in some trouble. And his wife and him, he had a nice home in Baton Rouge. And I'd spent several nights there in Baton Rouge at his house, a very nice family. And he got... I can't think what the deal was now, but he was at a halfway house where he had to stay and report in, and he just had gotten back. I think he'd been home visiting his wife, and he'd go back to New Orleans where he was staying, and got out of his car or was getting out of his car in the parking lot and got machine gunned down or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew what drug cartel did to start with. I knew what was going to happen when he set them guys up down there. I knew what was going to happen. So I kind of did a magic trick and disappeared and just broke all ties with them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I filled up a lot of hours.
Bo Greitz went public. I guess back in the late 70s, he went in to visit Khun Sa in the Karen state, and that's the, you know, they grow a lot of poppies up there, too, and Khun Sa told him, identified a picture of Richard Armitage as the person that was buying all his drugs, and, you know, Armitage is still in our State Department, and he was in Vietnam, and every once in a while, you'll see him on the news. So, and from all accounts, the CIA has been running drugs to finance their off-the-books black operations for a long time. They took over the drug trade from the British, I guess, in the late 50s, early 60s, and been running ever since.
Well, yeah, and they're still doing it. They was bringing opium out of Vietnam down there in the Triangle and flying it back to the States, and they was started out putting it, drugs in the body bags. It was the service guys getting whacked and putting it in body bags, and they had their connections there at the States where they was coming into. I think it was Dover Airport. And they was bringing the bodies in there, and the people inside was removing the coke and the opium and whatever else they were shipping out of the body bags and sending it elsewhere where it was going.
Scary stuff.
There was literally tons. There was literally tons in that 10 years of Nam. There was tons and tons of illegal drugs coming out of there to the States. And it was all CIA covert operations. When you call it covert operations, it covers from A to Z.
Yep. And it's just kind of one of those things that everybody kind of knows. It looks like UFOs. You know, everybody knows they exist, but, you know, the government don't know nothing about it. And you know, I was talking with Raylan Allen, you know, from Rumor Mill News, and, you know, she was married to the number three guy at the CIA for a few years, and he was a guy that flew George Bush. George Bush disappeared for 23 hours, and he went to Paris, and he was a guy that arranged that the Iranian hostages not be released until after Carter was out of office. And anyway, so he flew him over there, and he was a guy that flew the Blackbirds. But yeah, she had an interesting life, and she was married to Gunther Rusbacher.
He wrote a book about the Blackbird and told about the uniform, special suits they had to have, the special windshield, what the temperature was, actually what the speed was of it was, I don't know, 50 miles, 45, 50 miles a
minute.
A minute or something like that. It was unbelievable.
SR-71,
yeah.
Amazing, you know, they come out with that in like 1959 or 60 and... And you know, and they've got planes now that fly to the edge of space, and I mean, that's nothing, you know, compared to what they've got now. I'm sure they've got anti-gravity and who knows what all now, and you don't know about it. Don't hear, you know, they.
You know, it's amazing how kind of like dumb we was from centuries ago up to like 1900, and then even in early 1900s, and then all of a sudden from 1900. 65 years or something, they put a man on the moon? And I'm figuring, you know, here in 1900, they're still driving horses and wagons, cowboys, robbing banks and everything, and then just a short span of 60 years, they put a man on the moon and all that, and
what?
I'm thinking, is there a connection with the spaceship in Roswell, New Mexico? What's that connection there?
Yeah. Well, speaking of that, you know, I've heard stories about big UFO sightings during big battles in Vietnam. Did you guys ever see anything in the sky above the canopy?
No. Well, I've seen a lot of tracer rounds going off and things like
that.
Other than that,
I've seen
some very fast objects. Me being an ex-pilot for 25 years, me and my wife used to set out at the airport at nighttime, where it was the most darkest at,
And we just sit up there and just looking up into the skies. And I would time things that would be streaking across the low atmosphere of the sky. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't in space. It was down low. And I would time it on my watch. And I'd say, I don't know of anything that flies that fast that we got. I mean, faster than an F-14 Tomcat or any of that, some of the faster planes. And I've never timed anything that fast.
Yeah, I saw a formation of 7 saucers go from horizon to horizon in 12 seconds or less the day after the last Chinese bomb, atomic bomb, above ground bomb test in 1976. I was standing on a street corner in Long Beach, California, and saw this with a friend, and they were huge. You know, they looked size wise, they were almost as minute of angle, they were almost as big as the moon. And they were way up there. I could tell they were, you know, between 50 and 100,000 feet. They were hauling V formation.
They've been seeing a lot of things up in Arizona, guys, around Phoenix and places like that.
Well, there was that guy that discovered that you put on night vision, you can see all kinds of them.
I was going to buy a night vision scope not too long ago, and I got sidetracked and didn't buy it,
mm-hmm.
but somebody else was telling me about getting a night vision scope, and,
mm-hmm.
and you can see a lot of things streaking up through the sky.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll have to try that.
So when did you get back in about 1970? Then when
yeah,
did you start
I finally got home about 71. I think it was October 31st, 1971. No, it was 70. I take it back. I was still in the military. I met my wife. I was still in the military coming home on the weekends, and I met my wife Elaine there, and we've been together about 45 years now, maybe 45, 46 years, something like that. So it was 1970.
And when did you start getting really involved in the Cherokee culture?
Oh, I've always been kind of side involved in it, but when I met Chief AJ back in 06, well, I got into it with you being up on Prophecy Keepers and
mm-hmm.
in your forums and
mm-hmm.
chatting back and forth. Me and you chatted back and forth, and I'd ask you some questions. You'd give me some answers about this and that, and you was the one that got me really started into it.
Well, I guess in 2005 you had that picture. Now, the one of the pictures that's running during the interview is a picture of you with the politicians there in Illinois, and that was taken in 2005. Yeah, I guess it's about 2004 was when I started the show, and a lot of people, I was given my Cherokee genealogy when I was 16, and really didn't start doing anything until about 1990, and then didn't do a whole lot really till about 98, when I was in graduate school. Of course, my first wife told me before she died, she says, "You haven't even started your own work." And she says, and I said, "Well, what is it?" She says, "Well, your work's with your own people." And then, you know, she passed away in 95. And then after that, I got on the internet and started putting stuff up and about the prophecies and stuff. I guess AJ had been involved prior to that. You know, people don't know, there's a lot of Indians in Illinois. There's just no real recognition, but there's a lot of them, a lot of Cherokees.
We had the closest, we're state recognized by several Illinois as a tribe, but they're just about all fell off. Most of them is all senior, way up in the senior years. I'll soon be 64, and a lot of them is older than me.
Yeah.
And they just dying off and just getting old and falling out. And then they had to deal with the AJ and the chief deputy. AJ couldn't make it down here. He was so busy with the Rugers
mm-hmm.
and breaking records. And
that happens in these tribes.
Down here to the church, yeah.
Corruption and people doing things wrong. And AJ didn't do anything wrong. It's so sad too, but it's endemic. I know in about 10 years ago, I saw an article where there was so much a corruption among the chiefs in Canada, that the women had broken 1,000 years of silence. They started turning their men into the government for corruption.
Oh, yeah. That's the way Standing Rock, the last election, they didn't like the other chief, so his name was Ron. My horse was called Thunder. And they elected this new guy, and now they're trying to get him out of office because he's been swindling money and things out. And I thought, God, why are they trying to act like Washington, D.C. and that bunch when they should be taking care of their tribe? The elders there should be taking care of the tribal members.
Mm-hmm.
But there, come wintertime, Casper said he gets one tank of fuel, and that's 50, 60 below zero. Their frost line, I'm used to a frost line here, like maybe 18 inches, 2 foot. Their water lines is buried at 40 and 50 foot, and they sometimes still freeze up there. And I thought, man, oh, man. And I said, doesn't the tribe help you, Casper? He said, they'll fill up our tank once or maybe twice in an emergency for our propane. But that's about all the help they give us.
Mm-hmm.
And,
well,
and I thought that, you know.
I mean, anybody can get that, you know.
Well, yeah.
Well, that's that LIHEAP program. A lot of people don't realize that Indian tribes administer the same programs that all the other poor people in this country get. They administer the food stamps and the LIHEAP and these block grants, just like a state or a county government would. And but yeah, Indians, they, you know, unless the tribe's rich. There's a few, very few of those. They don't get anything special. They just get, they actually get poorer health care than the rest of the population does because.
Oh, yeah. And there's two casinos up at Standing Rock. And I asked Casper, I said, don't you guys get any money from the casinos or anything? He said, no, it goes into the tribal council, but we don't see any of it per se. And up at Cherokee, North Carolina, from the casinos up there, it all depends on your family size, but some of the people get as much as $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 a month.
Well, Gary Riggs told me back in 1998, he's got, you know, friends in the tribe, in the Eastern Band, and he said that there was a lot of questions being asked because they were wondering where all the money went. So there was a public meeting that was being televised. And they called in the guy from Harris Casino, and he testified that Harris had turned over enough money to the tribe to give each enrolled member of the tribe $10,000 a year. I think they were only getting 3 or 6 or so. Anyway, chairs started flying, and they pulled the plug on the TV show, and so, you know.
Yeah.
I was into that.
Well. It's like Chad Smith up there, him with his big private airplane. He had a beach king there, too. And they estimated he'd spent over, like, I don't know, $6 million on just fuel, maintenance, and taking, supposed to be business trips, but they was all pleasure trips with his family and in his private airplane. And I guess Mr. Brown got elected. I think it was they found out that Chad was trying to buy votes, and I think they had a recount on that election.
They did.
Did they? I was thinking they did, and they found out that there was a lot of bribery where he was out giving money to buy votes and things
like
that.
Well, Joe Sitting Owl has video to prove that Tahlequah was spending at least $900,000 a year fighting against the little, you know, unrecognized Cherokee tribes. And they really turned up the heat. See, what was going on in Tennessee was the central band is they got some people inside the band that they bought land in Tennessee and had land that qualified under the gaming compact. And of course, they needed some Indians, and so that was the plan. They got part of the tribe to start making accusations against Joe Sitting Owl, and none of them stuck, you know, including that he was a sex criminal. None of this stuff stuck, but they managed to vote him out of office and just make life very miserable for him. But we'll be interviewing Joe Sitting Owl about that and the situation with the Central Band sometime.
He lives in Lawrenceburg, Tennessee. Yeah,
right.
Okay.
It's right in the middle of the old 1806 Congressional Cherokee Reservation, and they have the 1794 authenticated Washington Peace Medal that was struck and given to the Cherokee chiefs at the time. It was kept in the families down here, and they've got it, and a lot of other artifacts. Joe bought the old historic bank building at Number 1 Public Square in Lawrenceburg. Had all this stuff in a vault, and the tribe was breaking in. He was forbidden to even go into the museum, and they came in and they stole all kinds of stuff, including out of the vault. And they got in there, and he was sleeping upstairs, but they get in there when he was asleep, and it was a real.
Somewhere I've seen where they had that padlock that was under judges.
Yep.
Judge had sealed that and chained it.
It was supposed to be a 3-day audit and lasted for 60 or 90 days. And when it was open, there was all kinds of stuff missing. And tribal members had safe deposit boxes in there. A lot of stuff had been stolen. And it's a real mess. I'll get Joe on sometime soon. And
and nobody knows who stole anything, do they?
Yeah, it was. Anyway, but well, anytime you want to take calls, Major Jones wants to talk to you.
Hey, I called him earlier and told him about the talk show and everything, and he's got a lot of good information. I told him he could get out to a lot of people out here and everything. He's into all kinds of things you're into too.
He's a reenactor, and we're going to have him on the line pretty quick. He's being dialed up right now. Just hang on a second. Oh, it's starting to rain here in Tennessee. We're going to get a lot of rain tomorrow. There we go.
Joe doesn't live too far from you, does he?
We got Major Major Gwee Jones.
Yeah.
And your friend and buddy. And Major Gwee Red Hawks Jones, Cherokee in Illinois. Now tell us about yourself. You guys chat for a while.
Hello,
man.
How's it going? Yeah, buddy called me early this morning. Early before the show.
Tell him a little bit about what you're into, Major.
Oh, I'm pretty much in the reenacting of the Civil War. And that's pretty much it so far.
Well, tell him about the Custer. He was telling me about going up to Montana and Custer's Battle of Bighorn reenactment.
Oh, yeah. In June, the 22nd, 23rd, and 24th of this year, Custer's battle is in Hardin. Montana, sorry. And they're looking for more warriors, and they're looking for more cavalry for the U.S. And what I'm looking for right now is about 20 mounted warriors and probably that dismounted to follow me.
That sounds like fun. Is that a reenactment, or is it going to be for a movie, or what?
Yeah, it's reenacting in be part of it. You can either get paid, or you can fill out 3 forms and just volunteer.
Oh, it sounds like fun. So
we're looking for actors and horse riders, and cavalry.
Yes, yes.
That sounds pretty good, Blue Otter. Let's be some of the cavalry.
It does. Well, we'll have to get the major on and some of his reenactors and talk about this. And well, tell us about yourself. You're Chickamauga descent, like me. And do you know much about your genealogy? And if you don't,
no,
you know,
sir. I don't know very much.
It's very. There's only one book, and it's a cost about, well, they were, you know, $15 books when they first come out, but Heart of the Eagle is what it's called. If you can find one for $200, you're lucky. And they came out about 99, something like that. And a fellow here in West Tennessee published it, and it's called Heart of the Eagle. And they've got, I think it's the only source that you can find for Chickamauga genealogy. Now, there's a little bit of information on my website at chickamauga-cherokee.com.
All right.
And the website's kind of a mess because it was migrated at one point and some of the links are broken. And there are some I did take some stuff out of that book and then moved, and I've been dragged through a lot of stuff. I don't have a copy of that book, but there are people that do. I know some one doctor in Kabul, Missouri's got a copy, Dr. Vickerman.
But and, yeah, I found out when I was 17 I was part Native American. My mom kept it from me. She didn't want me to get discriminated against in high school.
Mm-hmm.
All during school and stuff like that. So she didn't say nothing until I was 17, when I was a junior in high school.
Oh, hey, there's one on Amazon, $95. Not bad. Heart of the Eagle, Dragon Canoe, and the Emergence of the Chickamauga Confederacy.
Yeah. $95 if I had the money.
Well, I spent $100 to get a copy of, when I had the money, of Tell Them They Lie by Traveler Bird, okay, about all the lies they told about Sequoia.
Huh.
But, we'll look around. Sometimes you can find a copy. And tell us what you know about your ancestors.
What I know about my ancestors is... Andersons came from, because my dad's mother's an Anderson, and they came from, I don't know where they came from, England or Scotland, something like that.
Scotland, probably.
And, yeah, and they migrated to Virginia. Well, mm-hmm. My descendant that migrated from Virginia to North Carolina, they owned half of Pitt County.
Hmm.
And they did own slaves. I won't deny that.
That's like my Stouts. They moved into the... They had a land grant in the 1730s in the Shenandoah Valley. And that's where they married into the Cherokees at that point.
Well, I don't know where the Andersons did marry into some native tribe, I don't know who, because it says the first Anderson, which is Henry Anderson, married an unnamed Native American woman.
In Pitt County?
In Pitt County.
Virginia?
So, no, North Carolina.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, that could have been any number of... Yeah, well, I looked on... A really good source for used books is addall.com. And believe it or not, that copy on Amazon, $95, that's the cheapest one. There's one at half.com for $120. And then Amazon UK has got copies for $157 and $177. Damn. So, yeah, if you scrape together $95 and buy it. And I wish the author would just republish it.
Well, I'm unfortunately to be stuck at right now because without a job, I'm pretty much able to help my parents out, watching my little brothers.
Well, that's warrior duty. That's good.
And, well, in my Jones family come from, I don't know, from across the water what part, but they come from North Carolina as well, Pitt County.
Mm-hmm.
So most of my dad's family comes from Pitt County, North Carolina.
Okay.
And I have balls in my family. they come from, I think, the old land as well. And they still use this, their twang talk too.
Mm-hmm.
From across the land. And they're from Hyde County, North Carolina. My mom's family, which I think my mom said my grandfather, Thomas Newton Watson, is half Cherokee or something. I believe it's half Cherokee because he got a letter from the nation.
Mm-hmm.
Could be Tuscarora, too.
But I can't prove it because we can't find the paper.
Yeah, that's pretty common, you know, when you wear a name, you know, that's almost a sure sign that, you know, that nobody knows who she was and there's rumors. I mean, that is so common among people where it's rumored, you know, to be. I was lucky. I was given my genealogy all the way back to 1803, and then it's known that she was born in Kentucky. But her father was on the Henderson roll, and that was Gardner Green, and his real name was Red Wolf. And then a friend of mine down in Florida knew the names of the family and where they came from all the way back to 1500. They're in the Wolf Clan territory near Chunky Gal Mountain in North Carolina.
And my mom's mother is, her maiden name is Adams. And my grandmother's mother was a full blood, what I'm told.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, I can't prove any of this on my mom's side.
Oh, that's
but
okay.
I can,
you know
but
you're
I can, what I, yeah, I know I'm 15. but I can prove my dad's side, but I don't know which tribe.
Oh, okay.
And we encourage
you to get a letter into the Cherokee Nation of Mexico and encourage you to identify with us.
And we do have Lumbee married into the family.
Oh, yeah, that's yeah, you could have, you know, Cherokee, Lumbee, Tuscarora,
on my dad's side,
Virginia could be Powhatan.
And on my mom's side would most definitely be Chickamauga because they're from Tennessee.
Mm-hmm. Whereabouts, do you know?
That I can't prove, but I do have sources saying my Smith family is from the mountains.
Mm-hmm. If they're down around Chattanooga, you know, they're probably
Smith, because, yeah, we do have Smith in the family. And guess what? You really want to know a name? We have a Captain John Smith.
Hmm.
But guess what? We don't know who he is.
Do you know what year? You know what year?
I don't know years.
Yeah. Hmm. If you can find that, it'd be interesting if you can find that out.
All I know is I have my mom and her family, which is Adams. Well, it starts out with, because I'll start out with my grandfather. Starts out Watson, Adams, and I think it's Allen's and Smith.
Mm-hmm. I wish
and
I had
think
a
my mom's
of the Eagle because they've got. Well, let me get into the website and yeah, keep talking.
And I think my mom's side has Andersons as well. So mom's family could be intertwined with my dad's family somehow, I'm not sure. Because of Anderson wise.
Yeah.
Then my dad's side is Anderson's, well, Jones Anderson, Crawford's balls.
Balls?
Get about 200. Yeah, ball.
How do you spell that? B-A-L-L?
B-A-L-L-S.
Balls. Well, that's awful close to Bowles. And Bowles, he was an English pirate that married into... his story is at Chickamauga-Cherokee.com. And he married into a couple different nations, and I believe he's the real famous Seminole Osceola. I think he's Osceola's grandfather, but so Bowles, that's awful. Yeah, Balls. I mean, I'll bet that's. Being a Southerner, they said, "Well, what's your name?" Well, my name's Balls, you know. So they probably wrote that Balls.
And but yeah, they're from Hyde County. The Balls are.
Huh.
Hyde
but
County,
not just,
North Carolina.
Not just Ball, but Balls.
Yeah, Balls.
Oh yeah, that sounds like your Balls, because he was a privateer, labeled a pirate.
Most likely, yeah, pirate.
And
that's most likely what they're all pirates. They're all pirates, so you ain't got to worry about it.
Yeah, exactly. And I'll send you some links about him. But yeah, he was. Let's see. I think I've got the page here. It'll take a little while to look him up here. Anyway.
I think you notice you're having ringing in your studio? It's most likely because you're on the computer.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I just thought I didn't know if you knew that or not, but I just thought I'd let you know.
Yeah, Chief Billy Bowlegs.
I think there's two Bowlegs. One was Seminole, one was a Creek.
That's correct. Yeah, and because they were from two different wives, and Bowles, the English pirate, was their father. But yeah, that's the story, Seminole and Creek, and that's what's on that on the website. And yeah, Bill Chance gave me that information, and that's been up online for quite a while.
I know him.
Yeah, excellent source, and.
But yeah, right now because I do research as well. What I'm not good at is family research, so I have to have somebody else do that.
Yeah, it takes time and money.
I'm pretty much into history for like wars and stuff like that. That's my main expertise is war, so.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you're wanting to find somebody in a unit or something, like in the Civil War, Revolutionary War or something, I'm pretty good with that.
Well, you're doing what you can, and you're reenacting history, which is a great thing to do, and because there's not a whole lot of Chickamauga Cherokees that are you know, really out there in the public, and they're very secretive, and they don't want recognition. And most of them don't want to have anything to do with the government. And I know there's a group in Mont Eagle, Tennessee, and there's several groups here. That's the Chickamauga. There's a few of them around.
I will say this. I'm not out there to say what's what. I'm not out there to prove anybody wrong, prove anybody right. I'm just out there to have fun, teach people what it was like for them back then, and
sure,
pretty much being I'm not able to serve in the military because of my injuries. I've had two wrecks in the past. This is what I'm able to do.
Well, that's good. More power to you. More power to you. But, well, was there any more stories you wanted to tell, Buddy, about anything?
Oh, I was just sitting here getting a good education listening to you two talk.
Well, you know, exchanging notes is how things are discovered. You know, people find relatives all the time, and
I don't want to interrupt anything, but
oh, that's cool. You know, there's a bit. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I sent you a message earlier in the week. I think it was early in the week. Maybe it was last week, but I was asking you if any of your family is from North Carolina as well.
Well, the Greens, is Gardner Green, who's on the Henderson roll, 1835. He joined up with Daniel Boone, helped open the Cumberland Gap, followed him all the way to Missouri, and the Northern Cherokee Nation of Old Louisiana Territory. They're all his descendants.
Well, I know.
But he came back. He knew that when the Treaty Party thing happened, he knew he needed to. So he was an old man, and he beat feet back to North Carolina to make sure he was on that roll. And then he passed away shortly thereafter, 1835.
Oh, that stinks. But yeah, I know my Anderson family split. I'm not saying split. They split off and say, yeah, I don't care about you or anything, but. They split into three sections that I know of. The main branch stayed in North Carolina. The next branch split off to Georgia and Mississippi.
Mm.
And I found out through my genealogy, because I have a Heather Anderson in my family, and she did the Anderson genealogy. And she found that, well, this is all she found out, is all the come back from 1700s, that there was actually Andersons in Missouri that were family.
See, my Andersons didn't get here from Sweden until about 1900. So before that, you know, my family was Hendrixes and Stouts. It was the two families that had married into the Cherokee Nation.
And we have Hendersons, Harrisons, and Harris in the family as well. And about 200 other names.
Mm-hmm.
And,
well,
go ahead.
No, keep going.
What we've found out, the Anderson side had about 8 family members that fought for the Confederacy.
Mm-hmm. Well, mine did too. My Stout's fifth great grandfather, Josiah M. and James, they lived right across the state line from Chattanooga in Walker County, Georgia, and they mustered in as officers in the Confederacy. They went to Polk County, Arkansas, and they were the commanding officer in the executive officer of the 1st Arkansas Cavalry Battalion, Company G. And they saw action in the Trans-Mississippi and captured Vicksburg at the Battle of Big Black River. The entire command was wiped out except for these two guys. And they gave up and spent the rest of the war at Anderson Island. And they went home I guess they migrated to Texas at some point. And they were cotton, you know, they were cotton farmers.
Well, I know that the Balls, because one of the Balls, which is the main one that I'm talking about right now, he fought for the Confederacy. He was caught twice and released. Well, he was caught 3 times and released all 3 times.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
And I had 2 of my family members fight for Longstreet's Corps.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my family members died at Cold Harbor.
Mm.
He was a captain. I think that's the only highest-ranking member of my family was a captain so far.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know nothing about my mom's family, but this is all my dad's family.
Well, you're doing good. You're doing good. Yeah, I lucked into, like I said, I had it handed to me. And I didn't, I knew about Gardner Green. And then I knew that, well, when I knew the Greens and the Franklins were an allied family. And then 37 or 8 members of the family attempted to enroll on the Dawes rolls in 1896. And they were rejected simply because they didn't live in Oklahoma. Except one of them did. The youngest one was in Tahlequah. But Chief Mays, I mean, back during that period of time, and I saw the flyer that went out all over the country, you know, oh, old settlers, come home, come home. But then you try to enroll, and they even had two elders stand up and say, yes, we remember their ancestor was Asam Franklin, and they said that he was a he looked like a half blood, but he was full blood. And of course, that back in those days, full blood meant your attitude was full blood Cherokee. But it's known that the Franklins descended from Savanuka, who was briefly the first beloved man of the Cherokee, like just before Okastoda, after Moytoyin and Okastoda.
Not only that, but the Cherokees don't even look like Native Americans. They were pale-faced just like the whites.
That's right, and their bone structure was clearly European. It's now been we've always said we migrated here in boats across the Eastern Ocean, and with the discovery of the projectile point discovered in a buried campfire at Cactus Hill, they say that, you know, people began arriving here 17,000 years ago, which moved it back, 4,000 years. They come from southern France. And that just verified what the ethnologists said back in the 1930s about us, was that, our bones look like, we were from Europe.
Yeah, what I was thinking was maybe we might migrate back to where we were at.
Yeah, well, but apparently the Delawares were here first because we called them the grandfathers. And the Chickasaw say that they also arrived here in boats. There's a lot of people that migrated here. Now you're in Illini, Illinois, and you're pretty close to Brewer's Cave. I mean, that was the area that the Mauritanians knew that Caligula was sending. He had bankrupted the Roman Empire. He sent 6 Roman legions against the Mauritanians in Morocco, and so the royal family of Morocco, they went south to Senegal, built boats, and they came over here in boats, and they knew where the friendly Indians were. They weren't down around the Gulf. They were up in Illinois, and Brewer was with a metal detector, and he was in a graveyard doing some work in your neighborhood, and he fell right into their treasury.
Cool.
But it's on Brewer's Cave. Look that up. That's right. They call that area Little Egypt because there's been so many Egyptian-type artifacts that have come out of there and, tri-racial looking. I've actually held some of them.
I was working on a battalion called Little Egypt because one of my friends is in the Armies of Tennessee, which is a Confederate organization out of Tennessee, out of the southeast area, for reenacting. And, I was part of his regiment because I was part of the 4th Tennessee Cavalry until I tried to link up with him at an event and kind of went to the next event instead because we couldn't find the main event that they were at. We went to the next event.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was kind of booted out of the group. I think I was booted out of the group. They didn't officially say I was booted out. I kind of figured that out. But I can't prove it.
Politics, huh?
Because I was in the group before I left, but when I came back after I posted online saying I'm at this Shiloh. I could not find this Shiloh. We were on the road 2 hours looking for this place, and it was dark. And the signs were on the ground. You couldn't hardly see them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, that happens. It's...
Man, what happened here? People knocking signs down. What's going on?
You start messing around with Indians, and all kinds of weird stuff happens. And I've been through it several. Anybody that's been involved with Native people, you know, they, I don't know, you know, especially if you know stuff, you know, you become a threat to others, and that's happened to me several times, and you just...
I know a few things, and I think some people don't like that either.
yeah. And, you know, some people want to play games, and some people want to do the real thing, and...
In the Civil War, I'm actually researching Native Americans in the Civil War, which I'm actually doing pretty good on that. And
first and second Cherokee Rifles, you know, they were Stan Waite's command, and I've got a friend out in Utah that's got, when his great-grandmother died, he was passed a trunk that had Confederate uniforms, letters that went back and forth between his ancestor, who was a descendant of the Bates family, like Kathy Bates, the actress, descendants of Dragging Canoe. And she's always claimed she was a Cherokee. And
we got Baker in the family, too.
Yeah, it's just kind of, you know, and then you have to, you know, you can even start looking at your, you know, at your teeth. I mean, your teeth can tell you sometimes if you're, a lot of people laugh at me, but, you know, a good dentist will tell you, you know, that the Native people have, you know, certain kinds of teeth.
My teeth.
You know, some of them are, you know, they just look different. And
My teeth are bad right now.
Sometimes, you know, your eye tooth, well, the one that back from the eye tooth, this one dentist told me, oh, he says, this tooth come in backwards. And I mentioned I was Cherokee. He says, oh, well, if you're an Indian, that's normal.
Oh, cool.
And I've had people laugh at me, you know, on the internet, you know, about the Indian. I mean, it's, you know, it's common knowledge, but people that don't know, they'll just laugh at you and, you know, call you fraud.
I've been reenacting since 2000. I started in artillery. Artillery.
Bob Bates, he was in Dances with Wolves. And so was, I just interviewed one of the elders up at Monotaca. He was in Dances with Wolves too. It's a fun way to, that breastplate that the buffalo bone breastplate that was given to Kevin Costner.
Yeah,
my friend Bob Strong Bear Bates made that.
Cool.
But he's out in Utah, and not sure how active he's an ex-Green Beret too. Was working as a police officer and Houston, got hit by a drunk driver, and I think he's had like 16 back surgeries. But he's got some time on his hands. He does some. He's got one heck of a collection of artifacts. It's amazing what he pull out of his vault. It's amazing to see.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, it sounds like you're looking for something.
No, I was actually unwinding my chain here for my dog.
Oh.
I have three dogs. But, yeah, like I said, I've been reenacting since 2000. I started out in artillery for 4 years. And, well, we did artillery and dismounted cav for 4 years. And the artillery was actually Confederate Union artillery. We intermingled gold through each other. So I had to basically buy both of them.
Well, they have some real nice reenactments. You know, quite often over here at Fort Loudoun, not too far from here. And
East Tennessee. French and Indian?
Yeah.
French and Indian or Revolutionary War?
They were looking for Cherokee warriors here recently.
Well, I've only did I do Cherokee on occasion. I don't always do it. I only do it when I'm asked to, because where I'm at, they're not common.
Mm-hmm.
So I basically dress up in a uniform. So I can't dress up as Native because I have the regalia and stuff. So
yeah, they were Fort Loudoun State Park. I just saw this the other day. They were looking for every once in a while. You have to keep your eye on it, and but they were doing. Yeah, it's a 1,200-acre site and location of one of the earliest British fortifications on the western frontier, built in 1756. It was nearby the principal towns of the Cherokee Nation, including Tenasserim, Tuskegee, the birthplace of Sequoia.
Yeah, I know where that's at.
Yeah, the Tellico Reservoir in the Appalachians. I had some friends, they're Chickamaugans here in town, and they go over there quite often.
Yeah, I've actually been asked to do one video, but guess what? This lady asked me all this information after she said, "Yeah, we could use you," and then she asked me the questions the day after she said, "Yeah, could use you," and after I said, "Well, I weigh over 200 pounds," she goes, "There wasn't no fat Indians."
Is that right? Huh? She was there. How tall are you?
I'm 5'8".
Yeah, well,
I'm 225 pounds.
Yeah, you might be, about 40. But, 222 at 6 foot, is high normal. So you're not that much overweight. And, I guarantee you there was some fat Indians.
Because.
Matter of fact,
I'm for sure they were fed really good.
Well, there was some fat Indians in that movie that Last of the Mohicans.
Yeah.
Yeah, I saw a few.
I'm not gonna make fun of somebody, but
hey, next time somebody says that, just tell them look up Hanging Maw. Hanging Maw was a Cherokee chief, and he was fat. That's what they call him, because he had a maw that hung down.
Well,
you know?
What's funny is, not trying to make fun of somebody, but look at, what's his name? He's a Lakota activist.
Oh, yeah. Well, she's talking about back when, and yeah.
Well, they had him for the Last of the Mohicans, one of the three, he was the main character.
Oh,
not John Day Lewis, but
you're talking about Russell.
Yeah, Russell Meade.
Yeah,
he's fat.
A little bit.
Well, I don't know if he is now, but he was in that movie.
Bit, yeah. Well, they sent him down to Frank Capra's mercenary training camp down in Alabama to train for the movie, and he was doing all his own running and everything in that movie. Yeah, they got him in shape, but yeah, he was a little bit overweight.
Well, what about John Day Lewis?
He
was pretty good. I liked him.
Yeah, that's an excellent movie, and it shows the look of the Eastern woodland Indian. Yeah. And have you got yourself a finger woven sash?
No, I don't. But I have an elder that made me leggings, and he made me a turban.
Well, those are easy to get. You just get on Amazon and you put in Métis sash, and you can get a good deal on them. They come out of Canada. The sashes. They're made up in Canada back then, just like now. They're the same. They were trade items. There were, you know, two or three. I've got the arrow pattern, and it's red. And
if you don't mind, are you able to send me that link?
Sure.
All right, thanks. Sure. And what I was told was the sash was given to you by your lady.
Yeah, they used to finger they used to make them.
Would you become married? You're given one by your woman.
Yeah,
that's what I was told.
Yeah, if you had one that. made them. But yeah, they're all the time. You can buy them, and you can buy the wide ones, and they also make skinny ones. And you can cut them in half, and so you can have matching